Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip and this is episode 139. In this episode, I speak to Ramesh Dissanayake about his amazing book, When I Opened the Shop. It came out, it was launched about a month ago by Te Heringa Waka University Press. Is an astounding piece of work. It really is quite an amazing novel and I just can't recommend it highly enough. In the conversation we get into a lot of what I love about it, but I just want to make sure that I am on the record. No, I just want to make sure that I honour this amazing book. And it's a fantastic read. It's very compelling, but also I think it's extremely politically astute, but it's also incredibly compassionate. And it's a stellar read. Can't recommend it highly enough. When I Opened the Bookshop by Ramesh Dissanayake. So get to it. Oh my gosh, maybe I should be in advertising. Anyway, so when we decided to have this conversation, I was interested in speaking to Ramesh about this stage of writing a book. The book has been out for a month. And I asked him if he would be willing to bring an object that was a way into the book and also a way into process and things like that. So Ramesh very kindly recommended that he and I read, well, he rereads and I read Agua Viva by Clarice Lispector. I am brand new to Clarice Lispector and I have read one other book of hers, but this one was an absolute revelation. Like I really enjoyed it. You'll hear me talk about it. I had trouble with it to start off with, but I really enjoyed it in the end. There are links to a couple of things that we talk about, both on the Podbean show page, and it should be in the show page of whatever podcast app you are listening to, but also I've made a decision to reinvigorate my website. As you know, I was all in boots and all to Substack a couple of months ago, and for a while, for at least a year, but I just found it not the right fit for me last year, as things started to surface around some of the people they were platforming in that app. So since then I've just been struggling to work out the best way to sort of house the podcast. It exists obviously as an RSS feed. You can get it places like Spotify. Speaking of terrible platform. No, sorry, I didn't say that. But you can also get it in most podcasting apps. But also, if you go to Podbean, there's a link to an RSS code that you can simply put into a podcasting app. But I thought, wouldn't it be fun? Well, I don't know. I'm a mess, really. But I have sort of launched the Better Off Red website, which is better-red.com, R-E-A-D. It's a terrible URL, but there you go. That's what we got in the generator. On there, I'm going to start putting up also a place that you can listen on a website to the podcast. So you can, there's a little audio file there and you can push play and just listen there if that's how you were listening in Substack before. So that's me. I always say we, but it's just me. I've launched a Buy Better Off Red, a coffee page. If people, who has money? No one has money. But if, say, you suddenly had some excess finances and you were thinking, I feel like supporting Better Off Red, you can do that by going to the Better Off Red buy a coffee, buy Better Off Red a coffee webpage, and there are links to that everywhere as well. I feel embarrassed asking, but there you go, I just asked. I did it. Anyway, back to the podcast, which is the most important thing. I am incredibly grateful to Ramesh. This is just such an excellent conversation. So I hope you enjoy it a lot. And thank you again for listening. And the webpage is a good place to get hold of me, better-red.com. You can get hold of me there if you've got any questions or comments or complaints or feedback or any of those things. You can get back to me there. I'm also pretty available. My name's Pip Adam and I'm available. You might know that by now. Yeah, I'm available on most social media platforms as well. But yeah, also, yeah, just, yeah. I'd love to hear from you, but also completely cool if you're too busy. Ah, there you go. Anyway, thank you for listening again to this highly professional podcast. I just had a ball talking to Ramesh. I walked away feeling so motivated and kind of refocused in a way. You know, I think we can get a bit, well, I can get a bit bogged down with all sorts of things which are peripheral noise to writing, but I feel like after sitting down with Ramesh, I sort of got recentered about what's important to me about writing. So yeah, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the show. Kia ora, sorry, it's me again. It's Pip again. Hi, can't get rid of me. I just need to let you know one thing. There is quite a lot of background noise in this recording, and it is wonderful background noise. It is so good. It is the primo background noise. There was a singing group happening next door, and you will hear some of their singing in this recording, especially if you're listening on headphones. Ramesh and I decided that it was fine, and we quite liked it. Hopefully we won't get a copyright takedown, but hey, if we do, I'll sort something else out. But yeah, so there's that noise. There is water noise, because when people when people are using the kitchen, which is quite close to her, and filling up jugs and filling up the zip and stuff like that, there's water noise in the background as well, and it's just sort of a low like that. So those are the two noises you'll hear. I like it, because it makes it feel like we're kind of out there doing it, and everybody, you know, like with a little whole bunch of people for company. So yeah, I just thought I'd let you know, just in case you're thinking, wait, is there singing in my house? It's not. It was where we recorded. So yeah, thank you so much. And again, enjoy this. Thank you, Ramesh. Kia ora, Ramesh, how are you?
Tēnā koe, Pip. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming. I'm so excited to talk to you about your amazing book and the Clarissa Spector book that you've also chosen for us to talk about, which I think, I really enjoyed, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. I was wondering if we could start. I was just wondering if you'd be willing to introduce yourself, however you want to introduce yourself as of today. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Ayu Bowan Venakam Maginama Ramesh Dissanayake. Hi, my name is Ramesh Dissanayake. I am a writer, poet, and chef from Te Whanganui Aotearoa, Wellington. I have a book out in the world, a novel called When I Open the Shop, which is published by Te Herenga Waka University Press. Also a chapbook poetry collection called Favourite Flavour House, which is featured in AUP New Poets, alongside two incredible poets, Tessa Keenan and Sadie Lawrence. My work and my creative practice revolves around food, identity, community, and decolonization. I am currently wearing an oversized vest with teddy bears on it. I am also a Taurus, so I'm a little bit stubborn and hard-headed, but I'm also kind and grounded, I feel. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Awesome, thank you so much. Oh my gosh, Taurus. They're kind of, is it true? Oh no, sorry. I'm going to ask anyway. Is it true that Taurans like comfy clothes?
Yes.
Or is that
It's true for me, but it's comfy and it has to have the right texture. Mm. Like for me, clothes have to have the right texture and weight. That's really important.
Yeah, I think I was a Tauran in another life, because I feel the same way. And also I live with someone who's a Taurus, and yeah, that I remember when they were born, I read a thing about, you know, and it said comfort. Mm. And therefore, I don't know if it's confirmation bias, but I've kind of like every time they put on comfortable clothes,
I think there's truth in that.
I really like it. So in this series, I'm kind of talking to people about where they're up to in the process of a book. And When I Opened the Shop was published, when was it launched? Is it a month ago yet?
A month, maybe 5 weeks.
Yeah, 5 weeks ago. And the AUP, the New Poets book, was that before or after this?
Do you mean its launch?
Yeah,
it's launched. It hasn't been released yet. It comes out on 9th of May.
Oh, cool. Oh, my gosh. That's exciting. And I guess, so were you working on both at the same time, or was it?
The poems in the collection are, you know, some of them are 5 years old, mm-hmm. some of them are new. I wrote the novel first and then put together the poetry collection. So I guess you could say it came after, but yeah, some of those poems are quite old.
Yeah, it's the New Poets, the AUP New Poets is one of my favourite publications of every year, because it kind of is this wonderful opportunity to read people kind of in community or in chorus with each other, you know, like it's a, or conversation is probably a better word, with each other. Like, yeah, this wonderful thing where you get to read three books kind of in one sort of, and that, you know, they share a production timeline and they share an editorial timeline. And yeah, it's a fantastic project that I think they're up to up there. Mm. Who was your editor?
My editor was Anne Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
And she was amazing to work with.
Yeah, she's one of my heroes. I really love Anne. So we're at this really interesting point with these two works. Like, you and I have known each other for quite a while, and I can't remember knowing you in a time where you're not, you know, like, one of the things that I really respect about you is the way that everything kind of feeds into the creative practice, you know, like nothing is kind of siloed off, like it's not like this is writing and this is not writing, or this is this and this is not that. And so I imagine you're working on other things, but if we can just talk about these two sort of projects, mainly when I open the shop, we're sort of at a time where it's sort of out to the world, like its creative process at the moment is that it's being read by other people and stuff like that. So I just wonder, like you've chosen a book for us to talk about today that is not written by you, and I just wonder, what is it about this book that sort of came to mind as something to talk about, you know, as something to talk about in relation to where this book's up to at the moment?
Yeah, so this book, Agua Viva by Clarice Lispector, is, you know, quite dear to my heart. I don't know if you have any found objects like this which you use to, you know, spark inspiration, or when you're feeling like you're in a rut, I always turn to this book to get me out of that. To describe it in rudimentary terms, it's about the creative process. It's an artist writing to a lover, or to the audience, or they're speaking to the work itself. It's not explicitly stated. It has no structure, no plot, and I want to acknowledge that for some readers who like that kind of thing in a work, this can be really confronting or frustrating. I first found this book at the City Library, and I didn't think much of it, and it sat on my bedside table for a long time. And then one day when I couldn't sleep, I picked it up and read it in one sitting, and it put me in like a delirium, a stupor. I couldn't make sense of it, but I know when something has impacted me, when it seeps into my dreams. So yeah, I had really vivid dreams after reading this. And since then, I've read it 3 or 4 times, and I use it as a kind of spell or incantation to kind of kickstart the creative process. So, yeah, that's why I've chosen this book here.
I really love the way you describe it. I must admit that I was similar. Like, I picked it up and read it and was like, uh-oh, And I'm not sure, like, the thing that I did like about it was it kind of almost resisted reading, which I always love a book that's kind of like, oh, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm doing my thing. But then again, I picked it up, and the second reading, yeah, I read it right the way through in one sitting and just was kind of like underlining pieces and just like an absolute awe of it. Like, it is a really incredible book and quite time machine-y as well, in that, you know, like, I mean, one of its main themes is kind of this idea of time. And I also love this idea of using it as a spell or as a creative spark. I think that there's something incredibly interesting about that. And I definitely have things like that, I think, in my own creative process. Did you were going to read something, yeah. Are you still willing to do it? Because that'd be amazing if you could read that.
Yeah, so this is probably one of my favorite sections of text in any book, and I've try to quote it or try to emulate it in my own poetry. It goes, "If I often paint caves, that is because they are my plunge into the earth, dark but haloed with brightness, and I, blood of nature, extravagant and dangerous caves, talisman of the earth, where stalactites, fossils, and rocks come together, and where the animals, mad by their own malign nature, seek refuge. The caves are my hell, forever dreaming cave with its fogs, memory, or longing, eerie, eerie, esoteric, greenish with the slime of time. Inside the dark cave glimmer the hanging rats with the cruciform wings of bats. I see downy and black spiders, mice and rats run frightened along the ground and up the walls. Between the scorpions, between the rocks, the scorpion. Crabs, just like themselves since prehistory, through deaths and births, would look like threatening beasts if they were the size of a man. Old cockroaches crawl in the murky light, and all of this is me. All is weighted with sleep when I paint a cave or write to you about it. From outside it comes, the clatter of dozens of wild horses stamping with dry hooves the darkness, and from the friction of the hooves the rejoicing is freed in sparks. Here I am, I and the cave, in the very time that will rot us."
Man, it's just, yeah, crikey. It's just, yeah, I think there is something so interesting about the way that it's written, and that it does seem to have that bypass of logic, if you know what I mean. Like, it definitely kind of speaks to, yeah, like, I felt these feelings kind of welling up with no kind of associated thoughts, if you know what I mean. And I think that that section really shows how, it really does seem to show exactly the nature of the book, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful dream, like, you know, and there is a dream logic to it as well, which I think is really interesting. This book, like, I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like it tries to capture something that isn't able to be captured in words. Like, I feel like that's the joy of it, is that it keeps trying to capture and have another go and have another go and have another go, which I think is really interesting. And I was thinking about, you have a lot of creative outlets, and I know that music, we've always talked about music, but there's also the cooking, there's just, you know, general life, there's fashion, there's all those kind of things. And I just wonder how you find, like, the limitations of writing. Like, is it something that you enjoy? And I guess I'm also thinking about writing in English as well, like, as a language that, I don't know, like, I only really know a couple of other languages and not very well, but they seem to be slightly more malleable than what English is. And I just wonder, yeah, do you find it a challenge or a frustration, or do you find it, you know, motivating? I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, I think I don't find it frustrating because I have all these other outlets to express myself.
Yeah.
So the limitations of language are helpful. It gives me parameters to work within and, you know, try to stretch those parameters as well. Through food, through poetry, through fiction writing, I feel like I'm getting at the same thing, trying to find out something about myself. They're just different modes or different instruments for exploring that. I'm really into, you know, using non-verbal creative practices to kickstart the written creative practice. So whether that's playing with clay or ceramics, or learning a new instrument for the first time, I like to do these things before I get started writing, as a way to be like, you know, get my subconscious churning these ideas. So yeah, I think writing and words can be limiting, but there's also so much you can do with them.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, this is probably because I don't understand the profession, but I was just thinking, in a kitchen, there must need to be, you know, because often work's delegated and you work as a sort of as a collaboration, there must need to be incredible communication around taste and around, like I'm even thinking of the cookbooks that I love reading, where, you know, they're like, it should taste like this, or it should, or add salt for taste, or that kind of thing. And I'm just wondering, is that true? Like, is there kind of an agreed vocabulary around taste in a kitchen? Or
That's one part of it. I feel like all the places I've worked, the food that is produced from that particular kitchen is influenced by, you know, the kind of equipment they have, the kind of storage they have, the staff that they have, and their kind of community that they're trying to cater to. At Rita, for example, we didn't use recipes or cookbooks. So you had to be on the same page as all the other chefs. And it was incredibly innovative, but it also kept you on your toes. So when someone mentioned, oh, we're making this sauce, you kind of had to know how to make that sauce and the variations of that sauce and what that sauce goes with. I think there is a lot of creativity in professional cookery.
I was just thinking, what I think is really impressive about the book is that I might be completely wrong here, and this is just my reading, but what I love about it is that there are moments where we're allowed to kind of taste the food, and moments when we're shown to see the food, or moments when we're told to feel the food. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that you do a really good job. I think that sometimes with food and fiction, it's really tempting to kind of just, you know, like, I don't know what the right word is. I want to use the word fetishize, but I don't mean it like that. But and I think that's what's incredible about this book, is that you've got a lot of control around how we're experiencing food in the book. And I think that it ties so beautifully into the work of making food as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think because I've worked so long in kitchens, there's a divide in my mind between professional cooking and cooking in a domestic setting. So professional cooking is laborious. It's boring at times, monotonous. I wanted to show those two sides of cooking.
Because there are the beautiful scenes of shared meals in there as well, which just, and shared shared labour around the cooking as well, which is just so beautiful. Yeah, it's really lovely. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to fiction? You know, like, I feel like there are lots of people, well, actually I don't know that many writers that are like this, but I feel like I've never met you. It wasn't like I met you in poetry and you came to fiction, or I met you in fiction and you came to poetry. It feels like there's a very much Ramesh genre, which is kind of isolated from those other things. But I just wonder, you know, that maybe I'm talking about the fictive, about the imagined, as opposed to the confessional or the, you know, autobiographical, which I think is another thing. You know, there's a definite blend of that in everything that you do. But I'm just wondering what your relationship is to fiction. Like, are you a big fiction reader? Like, do you enjoy fiction as a genre?
I'm not a big reader in general, mm-hmm. But I do enjoy reading fiction. My process for writing fiction is a process of unlearning.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you an analogy, when I'd been a chef for about 11 years, had cooked in Michelin-starred kitchens, travelled around the world, but when I went to cook Sri Lankan food, the food that I'd grown up with, I didn't have the tools to be able to do it. You know, it'd been ingrained in me to sweat your onions and mirepoix first, or simmer meats until they're falling off the bone. But in Sri Lankan food, you don't really do that. There's dishes where you just put everything in a pot and put it on to boil as hard as you can, which is really counterintuitive. Well, it was for me at the time. So my approach to writing fiction was kind of similar. I was like, at first I tried to write what I thought fiction should be and what it should sound like. And then through drafts, through redrafts, it was like, okay, no, I'm going to write it in my own way, in the way that I know how, with the tools that I have. And so it was kind of like, yeah, speaking my truth and getting as close to that truth as possible.
Mm-hmm. I really love that. I feel, yeah, like, I think, yeah, I often feel like what I'm always trying to do is break what I, you know, I always feel like every time I come to writing, it's a process of breaking and breaking and breaking and breaking. Because, yeah, I mean, a lot of the, yeah, I think that, you know, it's that thing of not always seeing myself reflected in the fiction, and therefore trying to then fit a life experience into that fiction. Mm. It's kind of like, wow, it doesn't fit, what's going on?
Mm.
So I really, like, I'm also interested kind of in the fiction that you're attracted to, or maybe let's not, like, stick to this genre sort of thing.
Mm.
Like, when you do read, like, are there books that you're attracted to? Like, and it doesn't have to be, you don't need to remember a book, but like, is there a type of book, you know, like if you read the first page, you're like, yep, this is one that I want to carry on with?
Yeah, you know, I want to say I'm attracted to books that are innovative and play with form,
mm-hmm.
but I also want to acknowledge that, you know, a book that is perceived to be innovative is, you know, that designation is coded.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's like BIPOC authors or queer authors that publish books, and they're like, people are like, wow, this is so innovative and fresh. But really, it's to that community, it's really normal and standard. So I do, when I say I'm into innovative books, I want to add that caveat. When I was writing this, I was really influenced by works such as Kohene, Toho by Kotuku,
mm-hmm.
Your work,
oh.
Beisua.
Mm.
So all these works do really unconventional things with narrative and storytelling, fragmentation. So I was really interested in that. I'm also interested in a really simple story told really plainly. I feel like there's a big art to just, you know, losing all the pretense or the show and just writing a story using simple sentences, which is much harder to do, but much more enjoyable to read.
And I think this is what I think is just the absolute, like, outright pleasure of when I open the shop is that, like, on a sentence by sentence, it's not, I keep doing that, like pushing me out, you know, like it's not saying not for you, you know, like, you know, but there's something incredible you do with the structure, if you know what I mean. Like, the building blocks are beautiful and accessible and wonderful, and then there's kind of this incredible kind of, I use this in the kindest terms, like fuckery with, you know, time, with space, with I really, really love it. And I think I was just reading, you were talking about the fact that it's a relatively slim book, and yeah, I think, as you know, I'm absolutely in love with the short novel. Like, I just think that TARDIS effect is so in play with this book, where it's, you know, the spine is this wide, but, you know, the reading of it is just this massive, expansive, expansive, expansive thing, which I just think is really good.
Yeah, to add to that, when I was writing it, I remember by the third draft, it was a question of accessibility. In the first draft, I was trying to do too much and trying to be too clever. But then I think about my family members who, you know, don't typically read texts in English. How can I write a story that they can relate to and that they can see themselves in? So, yeah, accessibility was a big one, and writing simple short sentences was done on purpose. Yeah,
It's a really that revision process is such a I don't know. It was funny because I really worship the work of Salisi, you know, that book about the writing workshop and, yeah, like craft
in the real world.
Yeah. And like just this idea that I think more and more I'm thinking about craft as such a personal journey, a journey of us, you know, bringing the body to the work, I think is what I think. And, you know, this ability to say, to take inventory and sort of say, I need to be simpler, or this is, you know, I don't know what it's like for you, but I often feel my ego kind of slipping in, you know, like I want to be read in a certain way, and I start getting in my head about what people will say and stuff like that. And I think that it's an incredibly it's kind of like a self challenging moment, you know, as well as the craft and making the craft say what I want to say. But yeah, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's incredibly confronting to when you have to cut your favorite passages in a text. You're like, man, this is so clever. This clever for this reason and this reason, but you know, if it doesn't serve the story, it has to go.
Yeah, and that's what I think I love most about writing, is that it very quickly becomes about serving something outside of myself rather than myself. I think that's where I'm in the best space. I'm a very selfish person, so it's quite good if I can get into that space, which I think is really good. I was just thinking, as I was rereading this book, I was just thinking about the poetic form. Louise Wallace wrote a really interesting article about the poetic form in your work. I recently reviewed Louise Wallace's amazing book, Ash, and I think there's lots about that review I'm not happy about, but one of the things I was like, it's not poetry, it moves the, you know what I mean? Like, I tried to make a claim for the poetic form being fiction, you know, it's just fiction in a different way. But I'm just wondering about, the reception seems very good to the poetics that are in it, you know, like there is quite an extended sequence in there, which I guess we're going to call poetry. No, but it is poetry, it's a poem. And I just wonder, I don't know, like, I mean, I'm sure everyone's saying, what was it about that that the fiction couldn't do and that kind of stuff? And, like, I have thoughts on that. Like, but I just wonder what the reception's been. Well, what I think I'm really wondering about is, what was it like to be producing something with those two modes in it? Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, it sort of almost seems like... I don't know, like a DJ sampling, or like an intersection of a stringed thing into a, you know, percussive work or something. Have you got thoughts about how that kind of balances in your brain, having those forms in there?
That's a really good question. And I'm also really loving reading Louise's book at the moment. And I can see the... It's really validating to see someone else do something similar in their work.
Yeah.
I feel like she has this academic background and the knowledge to back up what she's doing, whereas I kind of intuited my way through the whole process. The reception has been pretty good. I haven't heard anyone say, oh, that's a bit too flowery for my liking, or what is that random-ass poem in the middle of it? You know, I was influenced by the TV show Atlanta. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, I love Atlanta. Yeah.
In particular, how each episode is kind of a genre in itself, and how it eludes definition, or how they do so much in a single season. So with every section of the novel, I kind of try to change the mood or the pace or the genre. And two-thirds of the way through, there's a standalone section called The Island, which I don't really know how it happened. I went to Mr. Bun in Kilburnie, got a massive flat white, and started writing this thing down on my phone. And something must have been happening in my subconscious for this to make sense in the work. And I just kind of went with it. Part of its purpose for being in there is a way to slow down the reading experience. The previous two sections are quite fast-paced, and at the end of the second section, we hit a kind of revelation or breakthrough. And there's no way I could keep up that pace to the end of the novel. It would have just been too much. So I describe it to my editor at Te Herengawaka University Press, Jasmine Sargent, as like, you know, in old-time movies or theatre shows, you have an intermission. Where you like go to the loo or get some more popcorn, top up your drink. So the island section is kind of like a toilet break. It's a way to reset, you know, just looking at it, there's more blank space on the page. So it forces you to slow down. It also, I think, resonates on a different level. It's essentially saying this, telling the same story of survival, but because of the form it is in and because of the context, it's kind of hitting a different part of your brain. So, yeah, I really like it in there, and I really like what it does to the story. And I can't see it without... You know, I can't see the story without the island section.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I love that, you know, that mention of Atlanta, because I think what I always find amazing about a season is that even though, like, everything is moving along, if you know what I mean. Like, it's all from the same, I don't know, like, psychic universe. But, you know, like, I always think about that Michael Jackson episode. But, you know, like, that it just... like the season wouldn't be completed without the standalone. You know, there's the standalones, but they've got something to say about the rest of the thing. And I feel the same way about the island. Like, I feel like it, you almost hear it coming in the, you know what I mean? Like, and then it echoes throughout the rest of it, which I just think is really, really great. And I love that idea of, you know, like watching other people do that as well. Like, it is a really, I don't know, like, I really like that. Yeah, we can find kindred, which I think is really, really interesting. I'm going to make another broad statement about your writing, and, you know, particularly about this book, I think. And that is that I don't think you're afraid to stray from a conventional Western kind of narrative arc, if you know what I mean, like a three act or beginning, middle, end, or, you know, even though, you know, like this is in sections and that. But and first of all, I guess I'm interested if that's a true statement or whether you see this as a straightforward telling of the story. The second thing I'm wondering about is if a book is fragmented, if it skips in time, if it does all these things, what is the container that holds it, if you know what I mean? Like, what is a complete work? Mm. And maybe you sort of see this more speaking to your other work. So just, I just wonder about those two questions about narrative structure.
Mm. Yeah, so I think I didn't intentionally set out to write something that messed around with form. Yeah, I don't know about you. I just do the thing, and then after I kind of analyze it and be like, try and make it fit into this box of, oh, this is what I'm trying to do. Mm. The first draft is, like you said, it's very much telling the story to yourself, and it's messy, but then that you might find like a seed or something in it, and you, in the second draft, you write towards that. So a lot of the writing that I do is, yeah, there's, in the initial stages, there's no purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of free flow and messy. It's only afterwards and with some time that I'm like, oh, this is what I'm trying to say here, or this is what I'm trying to get at. So, yeah, writing this book was very much like that. I just had an initial spark of a person who owns a noodle shop, and it's on the upper end of the terrace. That's literally all I had to go with, and I started writing from there, and all these things came out, and eventually I'm like, oh, okay, this is what this work is trying to be. And then once I'd figured that out, all my edits and revisions were kind of honing in on that. Mm-hmm. So that was the process of writing that. In my eyes, I think it's a pretty conventional story. Mm-hmm. on one level. It's three act structure. Yeah, the arc and the pacing, I feel like, is pretty standard by Western standards. But on another level, it's kind of doing something that is true for my community. And, you know, the reader experience is quite different depending on where you're coming from, and I quite like that about the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I really love that. I think I remember someone saying to me, like, I was like, I don't know about Hero's Journey and blah, blah, blah. But they were like, some minds are going to psychologically expect that. So yes. If you're under, what's the word called, like, if you're subverting that, if I'm subverting that, I need to be aware. Yes. that could be a possible reading. Otherwise, yeah, like, then, I don't know, like, more and more I feel like, I think that there was a misunderstanding with my work to start off with, that I was trying to push the reader out of the book, but I've always been trying to invite the reader in. And I think one of the things for me which was really good was sort of going back and saying, oh, this is what an Icelandic saga looks like. This is what, you know, like, the hero's journey looks like. This is what this react structure. Yeah, and I just think it has been really, really useful. And also, I often feel like if there's a relative, if I meet someone halfway, it gives me much more room to fuck about in other ways. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, rawr. I really, really love it. I wonder, like, yeah, I just, I, one of the things I'm quite interested in is, like, this stage of the, you know, because I'm doing it now, people are asking you to talk about the book a lot. And I'm wondering, I mean, it's a pretty simple question. I'm just wondering how you're finding that, how you're finding talking about the book to a wide range of audiences, because, you know, there's all sorts of different people that you're talking to. And I'm just wondering, you know, how that feels.
Yeah, I mean, it's a roller coaster, to be honest. Some days I just want to crawl under a weighted blanket and watch NBA all day. Other days I'm really motivated and excited. Hearing the feedback from people who have read the book really motivates me and brings me joy, and it gives me energy to, you know, talk about this book and kind of promote it, to get it out there to as many people as possible. So mostly I'm doing okay. Things are busy, but I'm really proud of what I've created, and I want to kind of honor it by speaking about it, by promoting it. So yeah, that's the energy I'm coming in with today.
Yeah, I really love, I think in that interview that you and Olive did for Starling, I think that what I really enjoyed was this, what's the right word? And I think, you know, Always Becoming has always been like this as well. You know, this idea that the book's written and then there's the job of offering the book and gifting the book, and that is part of the writing process, which I've thought is a really because I think what it builds as well is that I think that this is the part of the process I feel like this is the part of the process that can get quite cynical, if you know what I mean. Like, I've been a few places, and you know, like, I remember seeing a writer that I loved and really respected, and I went and saw three sessions at a festival, and they said exactly the same thing in all three sessions. And I was like, well, of course you would. I mean, gosh, you've got to protect yourself, and, you know, this is one approach. But I just think I really loved that when you and Olive were saying it, and I also often think about it with Always Becoming, just this idea that the publication, you know, like, having input on the cover, having input on how it looks, this is, you know, this is part of the creative process. It's part of honouring what you've done, which I think is different perhaps than how a different group of people might look at it.
I mean, I think of it as like a friend. Like, you'd have a friend's back, you'd boost them up, and you want them to do well in the world. So yeah, that's how I think of it.
I love that so much, because I think, yeah, I think, again, it's kind of, yeah, I have a friend who's a singer, and my son was suffering very badly from stage fright, and she said to him, you know, like, your job, it's not about you, it's about the work. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you don't need to be nervous, like, because, yeah, you're trying to do this for the work, which I just think is really, really great. I've got a strange question, which I think leads on from this, and don't answer it if you don't want to, but I just wonder how you think about who the book belongs to at this stage, you know what I mean? Like, I personally always have this weird thing where the book's mine, and then just with each draft it becomes more and more people's, you know what I mean? And I just wonder, do you have a thought about who it belongs to?
It definitely doesn't belong to me. That's the short answer. I think it belongs to the people who have influenced it. So I've had many readers who have shaped the form of the novel. It belongs to the different intersecting communities that I belong to. So the HOSPO community, the chef community, the community of migrants, and also the community of ancestors, which I come from. But I'm also, I'm just like a hype man for the book at this stage. I feel like it's out of my hands. I have no control over who reads it, who doesn't read it, and that's kind of neat. I like that idea.
Yeah, I really love that idea as well. And I just think, I'm thinking a lot at the moment about, I've been reading lots about kind of, sampling and, you know, that idea of this weird idea we have around, you know, intellectual property and an idea being owned. And yeah, like I just think what I really love is that often now, having done a lot of that reading, is when I see an author's name on a book, I kind of think, oh, this is the guide, or this is the translator of all this experience, or this is the person who ordered these things in this particular order, which I really, really love now. And I think it's changed the way that I read books as well, which I really love.
For sure. And like the process of writing a novel, it's, you don't do it alone, you know? you really can't do it alone. From editors to the people who design the cover, which is huge.
Mm.
There's so many people that are involved in the process that you can't just claim the work as your own.
Yeah, I totally agree. The cover is great, by the way.
Mm.
Is that Todd or is that...
No, so it was done by H.Y. Chai, who is an amazing graphic designer, artist in Ōtautahi. I was connected to them by Kerri-Anne Lee. Awesome. Todd did the font and mm-hmm. the typesetting.
Mm. Oh my gosh, yeah, Kerri-Anne Lee, whoop.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah, one of the greatest people. Actually, we were just saying last time we were here, I think Kerri-Anne Lee was interviewing us or had organised it. Or
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I owe a lot to Kerri-Anne Lee, and she's really been a champion for Asian creatives in Aotearoa. You know, I feel like I got my start because of her and mm-hmm. Amy Wing. And like I was saying before, we met, I don't know, 5 years ago in this very building and did a radio interview together, mm. and that was thanks to Kerri-Anne. Mm. So shout out to Kerri-Anne.
Yay, Kerri-Anne. Oh, gosh. We are lucky to live in the time of so many incredible people. I don't know. I was wanting to ask a question, and again, you don't have to answer it, but I was really interested in a question around timelines, like around working on more than one project at once and stuff like that. And I think it's interesting that the AUP New Poets comes out as well. And I'm just wondering, are you someone who is single-minded on one project? It doesn't sound like it because you've always got other things going on, but with your writing, how do you differentiate for starters, and or do you? And is, you know, like, are you always writing, I guess is what I'm sort of saying.
Yeah, I'm... I am always writing, but I'm not really sitting at my desk and writing.
Mm,
I'm
yeah.
writing in a notepad, writing on my phone at like 3 or 4 in the morning, or kind of just going over lines in my head. I am a firm believer that with too much time, I will get nothing done. So I need to keep myself busy, so when I do find moments to write or to work, you really make the most of it. So that's kind of why I have like to have a few things on the go.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, writing a novel is, you know, an incredibly arduous process, and it does require you to kind of show up every day. So that's... You know, I say that I like to have a lot of things on the go, and I like to find small windows of time, but writing the novel took a lot, and it took a lot of hours and a lot of sacrifice and commitment. But having those other things influencing the novel helped.
Yeah, I was just, as you were saying it, sorry, I don't know why funding's on my mind, but as you were saying it, I was just thinking... This is yet another flaw with our funding.
Mm.
You know, like, we don't fund an artist to work, we fund a project. Mm. And like, it's just so, I don't know about anyone else, oops, about to make a confession, but so often I've tried to, you know, manipulate something into a project shaped kind of to make a funding application. And I was thinking, life is so different from that. You know what I mean? Like, it really isn't, yeah, like, I just, think how wonderful it would be to fund someone to like go running and I don't know, hang out with friends and see what happens at the end, you know, what creative project happens at the end of that. Yeah
I think that process is flawed, and we are forced to kind of play along or play along inside those parameters, which, you know, is a big issue.
Yeah. I was just thinking as well, like, with having, like, making food and creating food as one of those outlets, like, I was just thinking how important it is for me when I'm writing a novel to remember how to finish things, if you know what I mean. Like, the novel just feels not again. Whereas I think that's why I'm always interested in, you know, like, I can cook this, and here it is, and we've eaten it, and awesome, you know. And or like, here's a short story and I've finished it, or here's a review and I've finished it, and you know, it's a really good feeling, I think. And that's what I think is really nice about this part as well, the stuff that you're saying, like, you know, an interview or a, you know, conversation or something like that also has a finish to it, which I think is really, really nice. I have a question that I'm asking everybody, I always get nervous about asking it. I think it's a cultural thing. My family did not. My family loves money but doesn't like talking about it. So I guess what I'm asking everyone is what they need to sustain their artistic work. Now, I'm interested in money, of course, and I hope it's okay to say this, but you're one of the people who I've taken incredible inspiration from, because I can't remember a time, you know, you've always worked, you know, and I feel like I find work incredibly generative. Like, I think I couldn't imagine not working and trying to write. But also it's that double-edged sword of, like you're saying, like, time, money, it just seems like a big melange. But maybe money isn't the most important thing. Like, maybe I'm putting it too far ahead. But I just wonder, what are the factors in your life that you need to sustain some kind of artistic practice?
I think I need friends, I need community, and I need family. I also need things that bring me joy, which is getting harder to find, by the way. I need to be inspired by, you know, what other people are doing. We've got a lot of amazing artists and poets in the city. I need to be out there to continue working. The money thing is a real thing. You know, I've kind of resigned to the fact that I will always have to do some other work as a writer, and I'm fine with that. I think when I was writing this book, I was working at English Language Partners, which is an incredible not-for-profit organization, and that work really fed into the writing that I was doing at the time. But then again, I'm also okay with the job that is completely unrelated to my creative practice, and it's also a good way to, you know, detune, so you're not always on, it's just mindless or...
I didn't prep you for this question, and you can just say no. But I also am very inspired by how politically engaged you are. And I think what I'm really learning from this discussion is I keep trying to build silos between things, but I think, you know, I really love the idea that it's a creative life we can live, you know, and writing is kind of just one part of that. And I feel like political engagement for me is also part of that. Like, I couldn't imagine writing if I wasn't politically engaged. However, at the moment, I'm a very old woman. I've lived for 54 years, and I just don't think I've ever felt quite how I feel right now. And it is that idea of joy is harder and harder to find. And what I'm really worried about is more and more I'm finding joy in escape, if you know what I mean. Yep. And I'm not down on escape. I think escape is great. But I'm just wondering, I don't know, how you feel about that balance of, yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like joy is also very useful politically. Like, I feel it is a political action as well. But I just... wonder, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just wanting to say it sucks at the moment, but yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, we, you know, the, and also just, I think that weird thing, I heard someone on the radio this morning arguing the idea that artists put the world in order, which I think is an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea, but I just, you know, like with an act of genocide happening, with like a white supremacist government, increasingly fascist, well, fascist from the start, I just wonder, you know, what is it to be writing right now, or what is it to be cooking right now, or what is it to be around friends right now?
I mean, I am incredibly alarmed and disheartened by the atrocities we are seeing around the world, in particular in the Congo, in West Papua, in Palestine, in Myanmar, and also here in Aotearoa. You know, for a person that feels some sort of kinship to people living under colonization around the world, it is a tough time at the moment. But I do believe in collective action, and I do believe that small acts of resistance can bring about change. So on one side you could say, I wrote this book, it has nothing to do with the political context that we are living in, but on another side it does make a small change in people's mindset, and that gives me hope for the potential of my writing and all my creative outputs, that it stands for what I believe in and will, you know, give some kind of hope or reassurance to like-minded people in this country and around the world. So that's kind of the way I look at it, and that's how I'm getting through it all.
Yeah, I do. I must admit, there does feel, I think there's an urgency, and I think that, and I know, you know, this is the thing that I think is so cool about being, you know, you both an audience of and producer of something, a certain type of creativity or art, is that, yeah, like, I mean, when I was thinking about the things that give me joy, it was the Clarice Lispector book, it was your book, it was reading Louise's book recently, it was Sylvan's book, you know, like, it's just, you know, like, yeah, it's very easy to have hope for the form, because the form just, you know, elicits so much joy in me. And also, this is what I think is so incredible about your book, is that I found it an incredible, it just seemed like this light that said alternative to colonization, alternative colonialism, you know, like, it just, there's something so, and, you know, I mean, yeah, I just feel like so many books that I'm reading at the moment have that hope in them, you know what I mean? And yeah, and they don't need to. I'm not saying they need to. And, you know, like, largely I'm not the audience for the books that I love, but I just think there's something, there definitely does seem to be something. I'm just so grateful that people keep writing. I think that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that idea of hope is important in any work, but 2/3 of the book is not about hope. It gets quite dark and quite sad boy, and that is also an important part to show. It can't just be like, oh, everything's fine, everything's chill, it's all good. You kind of have to show both sides, I feel.
I totally agree. We've come to the end of my questions. Is there anything else you want to say?
Maybe I can tell you where I'm at right now.
Yeah, that'd be really good. If you're willing to do that, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, so I've been back in Te Whanganui a Tara for about a month and a half. I'm really enjoying connecting with people who I haven't seen in a long time. I'm enjoying chestnuts at the moment. They're midway through their season, and I roasted some with butter, and they were delicious. Feijoas as well. I'm really enjoying feijoas after, you know, spending a year in Nam and not having access to them. I am reading and enjoying Louise Wallace's new book, Ash, Ayla Huia's poetry collection, Talia, and also Rushi Vasa's collection, When I Reach for Your Pulse. I'm busier than I'd like to be, and I'm trying to find time to slow down and zone out. But I'm also energized by, you know, all this kind of momentum that is happening right now. Yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ramesh. Oh my goodness. Thank you for your book. Like, yeah. And I'm so looking forward to the AUP New Writers. Like, I just cannot wait.
Yeah, I'm just as proud of the poetry collection as I am of the book. Part of me feels really shy for having so much out in the world. But, you know, I've been working on these things for a long time, and yeah, really excited to have them out in the world.
Yeah, it's so great. Are there any launch events happening for the new poets? Do you remember dates? Oh, good. Reaching for a phone. It's terrible when I just, like, spring things on people. Like, do you think you could just tell me everything? Because it's coming out, did you say 5th of May? No, 8th of May.
So it is in bookstores on the 9th of May, and the book launch will be at Unity on the 29th of May.
In Wellington?
In Wellington, yeah.
Awesome. That'll be so good. We'll look forward to it. Thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are, and, yeah, just thanks for everything.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome talking to you.
Yay.